session number 23213, rule 18.
How much training they did?
You were saying that they started with basic training in Marines, and then they went on to
They did the commando course.
Yeah, then they
did military training part one and military training part two.
And I think part two was the counterinsurgency.
Yeah, it came in. That's right. Counterinsurgency was basic counterinsurgency to fit them in anywhere in the world, because in the 60s we had quite a lot going on in various places such as Borneo, Aden, and we also had the potential in the Gulf for young officers to go and serve with the Sultan of Oman's army. So therefore, teaching them about minor tactics in insurgency was a very valid point, and they were very keen on it.
Where did they do their exercise?
Well, we did one at Stanford. I tried to keep away from Dartmoor because Dartmoor is not a typical insurgency area. One or two areas where people with private estates allowed us to train. And I say Stanford was an ideal place. There we used to drop them off in two, one on the north part, one on the south part of the training area. And they operated against each other. Pretty planned, but it was the first time they'd get helicopters, and you'd say they think it'd be a free tunner would arrive to move half a platoon when two helicopters would come over the top. Things like that. We got them thinking ambushing, patrols, all the things that you do in counterinsurgency. And also anti-ambush drills and that sort of thing.
Were you able to draw on your own personal experience of Malaya and Kenya as part of the...
Oh, yes. I mean, Malaya, same Borneo in certain respects, but it was obviously they were a better trained lot, the Indonesians, in some respects, with more sophisticated weapons. But I don't know if they were any more sophisticated than the communist terrorists who had been at it for years and years and years.
Well, the Indonesians were, in effect, a regular army using irregular tactics.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, I'm not certain that they were that good, because a lot of these Asian countries are not that good. I mustn't say that if I meet anybody. Yeah, go on.
Were there any particular general principles of counterinsurgency which you were inculcating when you were doing this?
Well, I think there were, but I can't remember them now. It was laid down by the CO of what he wanted taught, and we did it.
And did it differ in any way from what you would have done if you had been training the army?
I don't think so. We had more time, obviously, to do it. I've never been in an army establishment until I went to the junior leaders after I left the commando training wing.
So amongst the sources of theory and doctrine, there were Robert Thompson's principles that came out of Malaya, and then later on, of course, there was Kitson writing about...
Well, he wrote mostly about Kenya.
Malaya and Kenya.
Did he? I've never read it.
Low intensity operations was his main work, but he was quite influential in the army.
Oh yeah, I mean everybody knew who he was, and he was a good operator as a junior officer. He was a DMIO.
And there was in most training, I think, a very strong emphasis on the primary importance of intelligence as the.
Yeah, well, as I said, intelligence has always been. Poor, as far as I'm concerned, and I don't know how good it is today.
Was there any specific training in intelligence work in Marines when they're doing the coin training?
Nope, not as I know of.
What were you doing for junior leaders?
I went to, when I left, I was just Limpson. I was asked if I'd like the job at junior leaders as training officer. It seemed a natural job to do. It's well documented what the junior leaders were. It produced about 60% of all senior NCOs and quartermasters in the years sort of in the 60s and 70s, and certainly all our people who have recently left as quartermasters were junior leaders at one time or another in the 60s. It gave a lot of juniors or young soldiers. They joined us. They had a year of education. Well, they had a year. They did seven terms at Oswald Street. Do you want me to go through them or not? All right. They came in. They had a term in just basic training, very basic training, as a 15, 16 year old. I forget the age they came in. They then did a year of more or less education. A lot of them were got up to A-level subjects, having had no O-levels when they joined us. And the material was very, very good. It was excellent. The thing that made me wince at times was some of the people who came round to call themselves teachers had allowed these good guys not to get one O-level. In those days, it was O-levels against GCSEs. And we took them through. They had a year on education. Then they had a year in training. And of course, if they were getting near to an A-level, they took it. And in the last year, they did basic military platoon training. They did adventure training all the way through, 1 week every term in the seven terms. And in fact, they didn't leave for junior leaders until they were basically nearly 18. Nobody in those days went on active service till they were over 18. And I don't think anybody should go on active service till they're over 18. But that may be not accepted these days.
There used to be the rule that no one would go abroad until they were 19.
Yeah, that was in the war. Yeah. But the caliber of these people who came to the junior leaders was excellent. Then they disbanded the junior leaders and got rid of them. And when Michael Rose became Adjutant General, he mightn't have done much as Adjutant General, but I believe he did one great thing, was to bring back the junior leader. It has to be where we're going to get the good NCOs of the future.
What was your own work then? Were you primarily involved with supervising instruction?
Imagine we had, I don't know how many, something like 700 or 800 junior leaders was all the instructors, making sure that they were up to standard. The programming, we had to do all the programming. And programming was a heartache, as you can imagine, trying to get the proverbial pint gallon into a pint pot. And I think we ran a very happy union. We got rid of a few, those that were never going to make it, which was pretty average disgrace to be thrown out of a junior leader, but they did get rid of those that were troublemakers. And we produced pretty good guys. I mean, all of them that I followed up from my own regiment have become pretty senior NCOs or quartermasters.
What sort of things would they get thrown out for then? What was regarded as...
Continual discipline. People who were not fit, i.e. were never going to be fit, were physically incapable of being an infantryman. Stealing, they'd be thrown out for stealing.
Did you have anything to do with the selection of them, or was that done elsewhere?
Sorry?
Did you have anything to do with the selection of
juniors? No, it was all done through the PSOs at recruiting centres.
So you had to accept what arrived?
What arrived, yeah. Generally, it was pretty good, because all the PSOs had been, and a lot of the schoolmasters had been, to the junior leaders. And I used to take round quite a lot of the schoolmasters who came from the inner cities such as Leeds, Bradford, Wolverhampton. And they'd come, often come with a chip on their shoulder that the military were no good. And when they left, every one of them said, what a wonderful training organisation. It wasn't my training organisation. It was the organisation that I was part of. And you had to be careful of the type of NCO you had there to train them. They had to be people who were, would be sympathetic one moment and not so sympathetic the next. You had junior officers, at least four of the junior officers I had have been or were major generals. So there you are. That was the type of person.
What happened after junior leaders? Where did you go next?
Junior leaders, I went to Chivna I went JWE to train FACs in England.
So you've been trained as an FAC.
Yeah.
And then you became an FAC trainer.
I went and redid the FAC course.
Has it changed at all since you've done it personally?
It was changing. It was in the position that it was changing in that we were now talking about airborne FACs and different methods of controlling. Still, the wirelesses weren't that good. And the RAF was interested. Because basically it was used, training had been in Borneo, training had been in Aden. There was also a requirement to be FACs in Germany. In the days when I did my course, the FAC was generally somebody within who worked with a squadron and then went out and did the FACing with them somewhere. We now had primary FACs who were primary little tactical air control teams. And we had secondary FACs who were FACs trained to take their place in units, rather like a mortar fire controller. I'm not certain that this was all that good a thing. It was not a... they never got enough practice. It looked all right on the statistics board for the admin inspection, FAC trained, and had done the course. And we had airborne FACs. I can't remember. I was trying to work out the other night how many FAC courses we ran a year. It might have been six or eight. I also, when instituted with the agreement of the Royal Air Force, that all pilots going through training, single-seater fast jet pilots, should do at least 2 hours FAC attacks during their period of at the operational conversion unit.
These tactical air control teams, what do they consist of?
I think an FAC, a signaler and a driver, and they were attached at brigade headquarters.
Would they be RAF?
They were both RAF and Army. Generally, Army were a fairly senior captain or major, and or a flight lieutenant on who was having a period off flying, such as buccaneer pilots or hunter pilots or whatever.
And they'd be attached to Brigade HQ.
At Brigade HQ, yeah.
Were they a brigade asset, you know?
FACs, two or three FACs, certainly two FACs I know got awards in Aden, and I know that they used the FAC successfully once or twice in Borneo. The proof of the pudding is in the eating, and
did they belong to the brigade?
They belonged to the brigade for their 2 or 3 years. Right. They still are.
How were the methods changing?
Well, basically we were using, to start with, we were using much more coloured smoke for target marking. It's always very difficult to know if you've got mortars near you, you can use a mortar smoke. If you've got artillery, you can use artillery smoke. Also, of course, target laser,
yeah.
Using the laser. But then against using the laser, you have the problem of where you do the training for this sort of thing. You've got to have the line of sight. And is open farmland in North Devon okay? I think not.
But also, open farmland in North Devon doesn't resemble the jungle in...
That is true, but I mean, when I was doing it, of course, Northwest Europe was still...
Indeed.
It was the problem, but with secondary for Aden and Borneo.
Well, I mean, the trouble with smoke is that the enemy can spoof you, can't they, by putting down
it's not very often that you do get that, you know, single shell. Then airborne was just coming in. Helicopter pilots flying, selecting target, then directing the aircraft.
Could you fly a helicopter and direct the
same? Well, very good question. I did have two accidents while I was doing this. It's all right with very experienced Army Air Corps pilots.
Yeah.
But with people just going through their first tour, very difficult. With young sergeant pilots who really want to fly around and wave to mummy as they go over a caravan site.
It's also rather difficult for helicopter pilots in the early stages to navigate as well as fly, isn't it?
But if they can navigate and fly, a lot of your time is spent on the ground, in fact, because you're not going to fly around giving away your position. You will land, plan your attack, position your helicopter, and position yourself so that the chopper is in a position to see the aircraft appearing, telling it when to pull up, telling it what it will see, i.e. when you pull up and turn through 45 degrees, you will see a large wood. Top left-hand corner, you will see a field running up. At the top of that is a Dutch barn, and in the corner of the Dutch barn is an enemy tank. Don't talk about glass houses, greenhouses. Greenhouses are greenhouses, are green. Glass houses are glass houses, and they're made of glass. You know, it worked. We tried all sorts of things. It caused a headache. We got smoke parties to put smoke down in the countryside so that they could do directions from the smoke. It worked. It was good. It did work. But it needed a lot of organization to get it working to my satisfaction, and to get people in ordinary, instead of doing it on Dartmoor or Seney Bridge or where there's nobody, you've got to do it in a place where there are people and where there are vehicles moving around and everything like that. Yeah, and we did all our airborne practice in North Devon, basically from Hartland Point to Biddeford and south to Okehampton, which is quite a large area, so we didn't overfly the area too much. And it worked, and generally people were, well, pilots were quite happy, because we used to have a debrief every night, both with ground FACs and with airborne FACs, with the pilots who had done the attacks.
Second World War pilots all say that it is extremely difficult acquiring targets on the ground, even if you're being talked onto them, and that it takes a lot of practice to become accurate in ground attack runs with rocket or gun or bomb because of the inherent difficulty of actually doing the business.
I think that may be true. I think it all depends on how much time If you take a Typhoon, which is a tank buster, and send it up,
yeah.
and it only fires once every four missions, mm-hmm. and he's a brand new pilot, he's not going to be terribly accurate. Mm-hmm. I was lucky at Chivna, all the people who flew for my courses were not student pilots, but were instructor pilots who had done live forward air controlling, or been controlled in Borneo, or not so much Borneo, Aden, and around the bazaars. So they knew what they were doing.
They were experienced.
Yeah, they were experienced. It worked. I mean, towards the end of my time teaching FAC, I sort of arranged a great big shoot-up on Salisbury Plain, and asked anybody who wanted to go and watch it could. And all the leading cowboys from Chivna came, plus one or two others, and we had a big shoot-up on all the tanks with rockets. And it was most spectacular.
Were they at that time doing that sort of thing for the School of Infantry?
No good going to that because it's all so pre. They had that terrible accident there during the war, which they still talk about. No, they don't do it. They didn't do it when I was there, and there was never any discussion about it. Most of the time, the discussion was with the Ministry of Defence, who didn't know what they were talking about anyway. And they used to come down about target marking. And then when you said, well, if it's going to be laser target marking, can we use the laser in... No, you can't use it in where you are. You'll have to go somewhere else. Well, by the time you've got the aircraft that are going to do it, going to fly from here to Timbuktu, they'll only do one run. I don't believe secondary FACs are really viable.
They've got to be full-timers.
Well, they're not going to get... I don't know how much an ordinary FAC gets, a year. I wouldn't think he gets more than 25 a year, and that's not very much. And if you've got to water that down to secondary FACs, there it is. I'm not certain.
You were saying something in your summary about being a forward air controller in Oman. How did that happen?
Well, that was after I left Chivna, when I left leaving Chivna. I went out to Oman I was asked to go out by the Air Force, really. They were having problems. They only had strike masters in Oman, and they had a lot of problems. They hadn't got the right radios. They hadn't got they were all secondary FACs. They were using really a sort of escape and evasion radios for to do forward air control. The whole thing was an absolute... Oh, terrible, because nobody was really, taking it under their wing. I actually wrote a paper, went there, tried to do it, didn't think much of it, wrote a paper off it and sent it back to Oman.
What did they want you to do then? Did they want you to investigate it and recommend?
Well, they didn't seem to have anybody who knew what really... what they were supposed to do. The whole thing was, it was one of these hodgepodge wars with a lot of money being thrown at it by the Sultan, a bit of fighting, and they were using the strike masters for machine gunning and dive bombing. I did actually fly on one or two missions, or three missions. But it's... like Afghanistan, really. You didn't know. You know, they fly a strike master, which I think had machine guns, and they used to fly at a tree and fire into it, and you might get two Arabs fall out of it. It was that sort of thing.
And how could you be sure they were the right Arabs?
Well, I suppose if it was the only tree, it would be the right Arabs. But I made a lot of recommendations. I don't know what they did, because I moved on, and that was it.
What sort of things did you think needed to be done then? To make it
well, they wanted to get themselves, people trained in FAC, if they possibly could, before they went to Oman. And what they required was an air-to-ground set which worked properly. It's no good using a sort of escape and evasion, really an SOS machine which talked. It'd be better off on the nowadays on the mobile telephone. I was there, what, 3 or 4 weeks. And
what sort of target marking system were they using then?
I can't remember.
Was it purely verbal?
I think it was verbal. I expect it was verbal, yeah. I honestly can't remember.
I think you also say you were a student pilot at one stage.
I wasn't a student pilot. It was student pilots I taught.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, at Chivna.
Yes. Oh, that must be the reason confusion. Did you have any idea of the bigger picture of what was going on in Oman at the time?
Well, they had a number of lines which... Yes, I did. I had a rough idea of what was going on, but it was, you had to be there some time to really work out what the situation was. I don't think I would have trusted anybody there. They were, they all looked like bandits. Every soldier had his own radio. In those days, they had these Japanese radios, walkie-talkies. They had these insurgents coming over from Muscat and from Aden, you know. It was they got on top of it in the end, but a funny old war.
You said it was like Afghanistan. Were you then flying over bare mountains? Was that
well, they're bare mountains with little or no. When I was there, there was little or no vegetation on them, so they were black and. We were flying fairly low, but I did actually do quite a lot of flying around in a Beaver, and went to one or two airstrips. Interesting. I don't think I really learned anything, and I did actually write a list of requirements and told them they'd have to what to do. Whether they did it or not, I cannot tell you. So you come on to Ark Royal.
Yes. Now, what is a CBLO?
Carrier Borne Liaison Officer. I was asked to do this job. My boss, actually, it was a chap called Admiral Gerritz, who you might have heard of, or you may not.
Yes.
Have you heard of him?
Met him.
Oh, you met him. Yeah, he lives in Salisbury. I then was told that I couldn't go to Ark Royal. I was told I would have to go and be CEO at Queen's University. I did point out I was totally and utterly unsuitable to go to Queen's University, Belfast. So I rang up Mr. Gerritz and he said, I'll fix you for Ark Royal. So that was it. My job on Ark Royal. I've been CBGLOs on carriers since certainly before the war, and certainly during the war. They were responsible basically for operations over the land. The Navy responsibility was for all operations at sea, obviously, but they had to have an officer on land. He had various tasks on board. One was strike planning. He ran the map store. And I can tell you, the map store in Ark Royal was horrendous. It was so large. It went from, you know, we had 1 in 50,000 maps for the whole of NATO. And on top of that, the east coast of America. And the Mediterranean. So you imagine 10 of each map.
Were we planning operations against the east coast of North America at that time?
No, we weren't, but we went there quite often.